Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 3rd, 1998. In the Creekside Room this afternoon is the presenter Mark Schween. Today's session number is 98-1, and it is titled Frostbite, the Poetry of Robert Frost. Let's listen in.
My name is Mark Schween, and this is the session entitled Frostbite. If you came here expecting that it was somehow going to be poor as a result of that title, you might be disappointed. I am going to be doing some work with Frost's poetry, both today and tomorrow, at the same time. See if a couple of you alternately could give me your copies. I'll see Cook, that's some of the folks who came in late. You get a copy here. And I hope, I guess, that each day will be self-contained enough so that the people who attend will leave with a couple of things. One, I hope a little more confidence, self-confidence in reading lyric poetry. That would be basically poetry that's shorter in form than the larger epic poetry or dramatic poetry, lyric poetry, and with perhaps a deeper appreciation for the work that Robert Frost has done. So I'm really using Frost's work as a way of talking a little bit about the lyric poem, and hopefully then after about half of today, which I'll use to make introductory remarks and take you through myself one of Frost's most familiar poems, we will then begin to work together on a couple of the poems on this sheet. Today I plan to use the side of this handout, which contains three poems, The Road Not Taken, Pile of Rock, and Spring Pool, and tomorrow some of the poems, if not all of them, on the reverse side of that. So if you're sure that you're going to be back tomorrow, you're welcome to take this handout and kind of think about the poems on the reverse side for tomorrow. If you're not sure, just turn the handout back into me and I can use it tomorrow. Okay, so basically I want to use today to answer three questions. First, why the lyric? Why did I decide to introduce with a poetry in the time I have to teach here at Holden this summer? Second, then why pick Frost? And third, why these poems? If there's any number of other poems. So let me just say a few things about lyric poetry. I think most folks feel a little daunted, afraid, uneasy about lyric poetry. It seems that most of them have either a sense that lyric poetry, sort of thing that often appears on greeting cards, seems too simple and sweet, almost trite, on the one hand, and on the other extreme, people think it's just too difficult, that it requires a special set of skills and a special kind of knowledge to be able to understand and appreciate lyric poetry. I want to suggest that neither of those impressions ought to withstand much scrutiny, and by introducing Frost, I think both of those assumptions about lyric poetry will be demolished. I think it's good to read lyric poetry and cultivate a sense of enjoyment and appreciation for it, because unlike a lot of literary forms, the other two kinds of poetry I mentioned, for instance, epic and dramatic poetry, or prose, lyric poetry can be, and I think should be, memorized to some degree. In other words, the nice thing about lyrics is that many of them are not only short, but because many of them, especially by Frost or Yeats or any number of other poets, have nice rhyme schemes which help you memorize. I mean, who doesn't remember, in the case of Frost, whose woods these are? I think I know his house is in the village row. He will not see me stopping here to see his woods fill up with snow. I mean, this is a beginning of a famous poem by Frost, and it's easy to remember because of the kind of rhyme scheme and meter that he uses, and that helps one commit them to memory. This whole notion of committing large stretches of literature, poetry, to memory, really cuts against the grain of the modern era, I think, which is prone to sound bites, which are often vacuous, though short, or tends to run toward modes of literature and art that are not particularly easy to memorize or not particularly memorable. So I would recommend, I think, if you wind up leaving here today or tomorrow, loving prose or loving lyric poetry, that you at some point learn to live with lyric poetry literally by memorizing a few and carrying them about in your head. I myself once thought, in my younger days as a teacher, that memory work or memorization was the antithesis, the opposite of serious education. That one had to cultivate critical thinking and to memorize something by rote was somehow mechanical and somehow not particularly, therefore, of value, even though I grew up in a school system, a parochial Lutheran school system, where the first thing we did every day was what we call memory work. And learned, therefore, to carry with me, and still can carry with me, though I'm not even aware of it, large stretches of Luther's Catechism, the Bible, and any number of other things, which suddenly will, on appropriate occasions, trip off of my tongue in ways that startle even me and sort of bore my friends. I've come round now full circle after thinking for most of my life as a teacher that this was kind of retrograde memory work, now to think that it's a great loss in our culture that we don't ask children to memorize the Bible, great poetry, and so forth. It helps to, I think, furnish the mind with wonderful things. It helps to discipline the mind in certain wonderful ways. And it gives you a kind of portable treasure house of wonderful ideas, well-formed, that you can draw upon, and you'll find yourself drawing upon in all kinds of emergencies. Some of the people I wound up studying, William James or John Stuart Mill, turn out in their lives, many other 19th century figures I've come across, to have literally, in pits of deep despair, sometimes almost suicidal despair, have told us in their autobiographies that it was only because certain Bible passages or certain stretches of Wordsworth poetry, in the case of Mill, Bible passages in the case of James, came to their minds in the midst of these crises, that they somehow found their way through them. So that this act of memorization on their part turned out literally to provide a kind of salvation for them at crucial passages in their lives. So this is a long way of saying that I like to get people to love or to reinvigorate their love of lyric poetry just because I think it's a wonderful literary form to memorize, and there's just lots and lots of great poetry, Shakespeare sonnets, any number of sonnets by the great English sonneteers from the 17th century forward. One could go on and on that one can and should, I think, carry with them for the rest of their days. Okay, so that's a little bit of why lyric poetry, but why then pick Frost when you could pick any number of other lyric poets? I like to do Frost with folks, I think partly because I think what's fun is to take up literature that is already to some degree, even though people may not realize it, familiar to them. Frost is so often in this country used in contexts like greeting cards, excerpted often, two roads diverged in a wood, and sorry I could not travel both, etc., etc. You'll find those, often those lines or the concluding lines of that poem on greeting cards, or you'll even find titles of books, The Road Not Taken or The Road Less Traveled, taken from Frost poetry. I would be surprised if people in here didn't at some point or another encounter Frost, either in class or in one of these other contexts. And I like to take something that seems familiar and that therefore gives people a kind of initial confidence through familiarity, and then begin to show through some discussion how powerfully and wonderfully complicated this is, these poems are, and how much they repay study. And I'm going to do a little bit about of that today with one of Frost's poems by way of introducing him. So that's one of the reasons I like to do Frost, to begin with something that's familiar and to make it seem even richer than we had imagined, or even to help to explain to you why you've always loved something, though you've not always quite known why you did, you just knew you did. And hopefully this will help to get you to see why you loved it all along. Secondly, I like to take Frost's poems because, as we'll see today, so much of his poetry is about the work of interpretation itself. Some of you were at Bible study today. Many of you were at Bible study today. And the way that the Bible study teacher suggested you might interpret the scriptures by asking at least two questions of any given story. What did you notice? What could this mean? I decided I'd adopt, to make connections with her class, a similar set of questions today on this poetry. And what I think is particularly wonderful about applying questions like that to Frost is that, as I just suggested, his poetry is actually about the way we go about interpreting. And I want to just say for a moment that all of us here, even though we may never again encounter a lyric poem, are almost 24 hours a day about the work of interpretation, about the work of knowing. Interpretation applies, to be sure, to poetry, but it's clear that you better be able to interpret the meaning of your child's next cry, better be able to interpret more than just the lexical surface meaning of what your spouse or brother or sister says to you next, because the same words could have a thousand different meanings depending on intonation and context and all the other things we automatically draw on to make sense. Interpretation informs everything from everyday life up to geopolitical crises. I always think in my growing up, the major crisis that the world came to in my formative years was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was very important that the Kennedy administration interpret one particular telegram of Khrushchev in one particular way. Had they interpreted it in another way, we might not all be sitting here today. So the stakes of interpretation, in other words, can get, in some contexts, very high. And all throughout our everyday life, they're always critically important. And so taking up Frost, who writes about interpretation, and working on his poems, gives us a kind of training, a set of skills through practice that we can draw upon not just in reading this poem. And finally, I pick Frost largely because Frost's own poetic resources, the things that he uses to achieve his wonderful effects, are really remarkably simple. His diction, meaning his word choice, the kind of words he uses, are very simple, everyday words, put together in stunning combinations, to be sure, but not calling upon us to rush to a dictionary every other sentence, as we might with somebody like Eliot or Ezra Pound. So Frost's surface meaning is very accessible. You can always understand at the first level just what he's saying, which we can't always with other lyric poets. And other resources he uses as a poet, his metrical schemes, his rhyme schemes, which we won't get in much to today, are wonderfully straightforward. He exemplifies something else which I admire, and this is a personal prejudice. He believes deeply in the old-fashioned disciplines of poetry. By that I mean to say he works a lot within conventional forms like the sonnet. He works a lot within fairly conventional rhyme schemes. He believes that these disciplines, and here's my prejudice, actually are liberating. Contrary to what so many people think when they work within conventions and disciplines and find these stultifying or oppressive, Frost finds them liberating and making speech and ideas possible and powerful. He once said of people who wrote in free verse, which liberates them completely from any metrical or rhythmic obligations, writing free verse is like playing tennis without a net. And what he meant by that, I think, is that the whole work of knowing that makes itself manifest in lyric poetry is given further power by virtue of these wonderful conventions. Let me illustrate that by just suggesting, for instance, table manners as being liberating. The fact that we don't have to sit down at the table every time that we sit down and say, well, gee, now, where should the knife go? Where is the fork? Let's have a conversation about whether we should put the water on this side or that, and should we use napkins? And the fact that we can take so much of that for granted in observing these manners frees us up to do other things like converse with each other, which is crucial to enjoy a meal. So the discipline of table manners, which many people would find stultifying, is actually sort of liberating, because it frees us up to do other things. And that's the same kind of thing Frost would say, or something like it, about his poetic conventions. Okay, so that's a little bit, maybe a little bit too much about why I picked Frost. Let's get into his poetry. What I'd like to do now, if you will join me, is to offer up myself the beginnings of a reading of one of his poems. I'm going to do most of the work on this one and then invite conversation about it. And after that, the work is going to be up to us together. And so what I hope to do is to just give you a kind of introduction in the way one might go about reading a poem by Frost, the kinds of questions one might possibly ask. And then as we get into that together, we'll pick other poems and do them from scratch together. And the one I picked is The Road Not Taken. I picked that because I always use that, or I always say different things about it to introduce Frost, and I always use it because it's the poem, except for maybe Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, that people think they already know. So let's basically see if there be anybody who loves to read poetry aloud and would like to volunteer to read The Road Not Taken. Any takers?
Sure, I'll look. Two roads diverged in the yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler long as I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, and where it bent in the undergrowth. May I finish it?
Keep going.
Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on the way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Great. Thank you. A huge number of people who've grown to love this poem, if asked, what is this poem about, would say something like this, that it's about the importance of luck in life, of making decisions which cut against the grain of what's popular. I think that the road less traveled is a kind of image for what would be a relatively unpopular or a relatively uncommon choice, and they think the poem is somehow a rather flowery and ornate way of making that point. They, in other words, think that the poem really didn't need its first three stanzas or even the first two lines of its last stanza. It could just as well have said, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. In fact, some greeting cards will have just those three lines, and some people think that's the whole of the poem. What I'm going to suggest a way into many poems might be is to begin to locate the one or two or three principal parts of the poem. And I've already suggested that this poem falls into really two major parts, both of them that begin exactly the same way. One part begins with line one, two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and another part begins with line 18, two roads diverge in a wood. And what I want to suggest is we begin, just begin to get into what's going on in this poem, if we begin to open up the energy and contrasts that develop between those two parts. We've got here two stories. We've got a speaker who's going to tell either the same story twice over or two very different stories, or two very different episodes. We have to decide which that is. And I just want to unpack some of the surface differences. In fact, maybe you can help. Just looking at the two narratives, I'm going to assume there are two different versions of the same event. One running from line 1 down to line 17, and the other from line 18 to 20. What are some of the differences between those two stories? What comes to your mind straightforwardly? This isn't a hard question.
Conflict.
Internal conflict, okay? There's internal conflict, certainly in the first story. There's a lot of internal indecision. What I like right now is just if you could point out, is there a conflict, you think, in the second narrative? Is there internal conflict in the second narrative? Okay, good. So one of the differences between story A and story B is that the first one seems to have internal conflict, the second one seems relatively, the first one, free of that. What are some other differences?
Descriptive. The first part is very descriptive. The last three verses or three lines are very
spare. Mm-hmm. Good. So we got a very ornate, detailed story the first time, which includes more descriptive detail as well as you've pointed out, internal conflict. And in the second one, we have a very simple psychology, not much internal conflict, and really not very much detail.
And also, in the first part, the two roads, he says they're equal, that both that morning equally lay. And in the second part, he's saying, I took the one less traveled.
Excellent. So it's not just that there's more detail in the first narrative than the second, that's true. It looks as though there's even downright contradictions. The first narrative, it looks as though the paths are very similar, if not totally equal. The second narrative, there seems to be no doubt that the speaker took the one that's less traveled. So one's less traveled than the other. Well, anything else?
I see a remorse in the first segment. It isn't in the second. It just, I don't know if remorse is the right word. It just doesn't work.
Okay, let's say it this way. We're going to bracket the question as to whether the attitude is one of regret in both or the first more than the second, but I think another point of difference is the different attitude or tone the speaker has toward the event he or she is describing. We don't know the gender, of course. So that there's a difference in that the speaker is conflicted in the first narrative, relatively not so in the second. Very detailed, to manifest a certain kind of uncertainty in the first narrative, very spare and confident in the second. But there's kind of a difference of tone or attitude between the two. But one could go on and on and on, and I think we will together as I ask you to join in. But notice now the whole poem begins to set up a field of energy and interest that it just doesn't have if you reduce it to the little moralism, gee, doing unpopular things is important or makes a difference in your life. Because now we've got a problem. Is this speaker a liar? This speaker tells a story the first time, and as this gentleman points out, reports to us that there are two paths that are equal. insofar as one being more worn or less than the other. And in the second narrative, we have a speaker who is very decisive and says one was less troubled than the other. So can we trust the speaker? Is he lying, or is he telling the truth, or what? Is there a way to reconcile this apparent discrepancy? Okay? Why should the speaker? Are there clues in the poem as to why some of the differences we pointed out, differences of tone, depth and detail, and so forth, should be different in this play?
Well, I wonder if actually lines 16 and 17 kind of act as a prologue to that second half, or why should we be telling this with the size somewhere ages and ages hence?
Excellent. Yes. You all follow this, and in other words, in answer to my question, do we get clues in the poem as to why the two should be different? Helps to figure out if we can somehow reconcile them. The suggestion is, well, the clue to the difference between the two might very well be because there's a difference in the time in this person's life that he or she will be telling this story. Because there's the imagining, as you pointed out, of what the speaker will be telling ages and ages hence, compared to what the speaker has just in fact told. Very good. So now we're into a fascinating notion here. Let's now imagine that this poem is about, to some degree, the different ways in which the stories we tell about ourselves, perhaps to ourselves, change over time. Okay? In other words, we tell a story about an important event, and this speaker seems to have the uncanny ability not only to tell that story a certain way, but to recognize that when he tells that story or she tells that story ages and ages hence, that story will be told differently in certain particular ways. Okay? Now let me just pause here to go outside the world of the poem for a moment. Is this something that you've ever noticed, that as you change and get into different contexts, get older, etc., but also have different experiences, you begin to refashion and reshape the narratives you tell to yourself about yourself? Is this something that seems strange, or is it something
that's up to
that? Well, I guess you don't have to. This isn't a confession class. But is it familiar to most of you? Now, maybe this tiny little lyric poem can help us see not just that is true, but why that is true and how that is true and what kinds of things go on in this tiny little lyric poem to help us understand a little bit more about why we do that kind of thing and how we do that kind of thing and when we do that kind of thing. Okay? Now then, how are we going to get to those sorts of issues? The poem, I think, gives us some clues as to how old this speaker might be. What stage in life is the speaker when the speaker tells narrative A, do you think? What temporal references are there? Gives us clues to any kind of time.
The yellow wood.
A yellow wood, and what time of year would that suggest? Okay. So there's something autumnal. What else? What other?
I think the reference of somewhere ages and ages hence.
Okay. So if the speaker can imagine him or herself telling it ages and ages hence, the speaker can't be, you know, like 70 years old. The speaker has to be younger than 70. And we have some suggestion of autumnal, which may suggest sort of late middle age, but are there other temporal references in here?
Morning.
Okay.
Well, I always thought he was fairly young, but not a teenager, because he says, yet knowing how way leads on to way. I mean, that to me, that demonstrates that he's had some life experience to realize. I mean, that doesn't sound like something that a 13 or 14 year old would be saying, you know, someone
super
that young.
Very good, very good. You're a great class here. We need to deliver a lecture here. But now, notice, she said there's a kind of, there's a sense in which there's something youthful, but it can't be that youthful because there's this second guessing of the self. And you've also said there's the autumn and the morning. If you take a poem like, for contrast, Stopping by the Woods, that is set on the darkest evening of the year. So what you have is that the cycle of the day, very late evening, and the cycle of the year, beginning with spring, summer, autumn, winter, coincide, right? Darkest evening of the year in Stopping by the Woods means that the temporal location and sense lines up the daily cycle, darkest evening, with the annual cycle, winter. But you notice that in this poem, they don't line up. You get morning, the beginning of the daily sequence, but you get autumn, which is toward the end of the annual sequence. And what you just said in psychological terms coincides with that. There's a kind of struggle between what we might call the speaker's, for lack of a better term, morning consciousness, with the speaker's autumn consciousness, okay? So there is something going on, at least in the first narrative, where we get all these details, which you pointed out, of morning and autumn, which suggests there's a kind of struggle going on here in terms of the speaker's age, which may mean that he or she is at a transitional point in his or her passages here, somewhere between leaving youth behind and beginning to grow into the meaning of middle age, where that wisdom that you pointed out is coming into play, which can enable him, as you pointed out, to begin to imagine cogently what he will be saying when he's old. So the temporal and psychological energies here are quite extraordinary, okay? And begin to take us into this question of why people remanufacture their narratives. Okay, with all of that as a kind of beginning, let's have another crack at just the first narrative, because I think we've hardly gotten into that. I'm going to have somebody read it again, and here's going to be my question. This is a tough one. At what point in the first narrative, does the speaker decide what he or she will do? Okay? Someone, would you mind rereading the first narrative? You did such a good job the first time. Which means we want you to start on line one and go up to line 15. First three stanzas.
Two roads diverse in the yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler, long I stood and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted to wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. Well, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on the way, I doubted if I should ever come back.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm thinking that the fourth line, and look down one as far as I could, is a real clue, because it involves the risk of what he sees and what he can't see. And then he, he's taking risk in this whole thing. It's what it seems to me. The choice to go where it isn't as obvious what lies ahead.
Do you think that it's right there at the end of line four, and look down one as far as I could, that he decides what to do? Which one to take?
No.
That's how I see it.
No. Six.
Then took the other as just as fair. You modify your...
Right.
Okay, but to your point still shouldn't be lost sight of, that he's a risk-taking person who makes a judgment fairly quickly, takes a risk, decides what to do, line six. This would be somebody who's almost impetuous, since he or she goes through a lot more reasoning after he or she has acted, if he or she makes the decision in line six. Now, anybody want to opt for another point in which the speaker makes the choice?
I don't think he ever really committed to the path that he really took, because he doubted if he should ever come back. I think he left his options open. I kept the first for another day, I think it was line 13, as if, okay, I'm going to go down this path, but if it's not the right path, I have an option of going back to the other path. And then what
he makes a decision that hedges his bets.
Yeah. That's what I see.
But you would like to argue, I take it, that he finally makes the decision, though it's a hedge, not in line 6, but not until the exclamatory, with the explanation point, line 13. So his decision is described in 13 as, I kept the first. His decision is described in line 6, I took the other. So now, at what point does he make that decision? We have two kind of arguments here. I mean, two nominations for when he makes the decision. And this isn't a trivial matter, because if we want to get into this speaker's psyche, if we want to find out something about the difference between a morning consciousness and an autumn consciousness, we ought to know whether the person is deliberative, sizes up the whole situation first, then decides something, or whether he decides something or she decides something fairly early, and then impresses him or herself, right?
Perhaps he doesn't decide until the second one.
That's why he's deciding.
Explain more about that.
Well, I think we often don't know the path we took, or we don't know it was the right path, or even the actual path, until afterwards.
Until we have something in perspective.
And we know that this is what we're taking.
Okay.
I think it's critical that he's telling us with a sigh. Ages and ages and ages.
Which gets back to your point, Val, about trolling it.
And we don't know how long he stood. There's a sense for me in that's some time that he stood and struggled with to take. And I think I would tend to agree with you that he didn't know until later.
I think he took the other in his mind and then kept arguing with himself until, I kept the first for another day. In other words, my picture of him is, then took the other, I've decided to take that one, but he's still standing there. Well, they're really kind of equal. Oh, I'll keep the first for another day. And then he starts moving. That's the mental picture I get.
I later realized that he didn't really keep it.
Say it again.
I later realized that he really couldn't keep
it. Oh, I see. And later comes to the recognition that though he thought he could keep the first, he really couldn't. Okay, yes.
So I say that I think that the autumn thing is not there. The yellow wood, I don't think, is important. I think it's there for the metric, right? You had to have a word in there that had two syllables. And yellow, I don't think, is important. You know, he had some kind of wood, and yellow worked, so we put it in. But it doesn't really match with the other stuff.
Okay, he has to, I would say this, if you want to argue that he just did it for metrical reasons, I mean, Frost was, I think, resourceful enough that he might have come up with another word that had two syllables, but more importantly, he seems to work pretty hard in the first stanza with the reference to in Steps No Leaves, Head Trodden Black. It's clear that he wants us to get fairly strongly in our mind, for some reason, that it's that season, because he has even more detail than it's being held with the leaves on the ground. But you may persuade us that he doesn't need the autumn, if you want to argue that it's really a kind of youthful spirit that he's got going in that first three stanzas, which I imagine is what you're suggesting, right? Okay. Well, we'll revisit that idea, that it's finally youth versus old age at the end. Now, I want to just pick up a couple of your points and then move forward. You say the sigh is important. Remember, the sigh is something the speaker imagines will be a feature of what he will be telling later, not necessarily of what he's just told. So that, with respect to the first narrative, getting back to my original question where we had some brilliant comments, when does he actually make the choice? We have sort of arguments on both sides, but some of you said you're not clear in line 6 that the took there refers to something he did, an action verb, or a mental state, that he sort of took it in his mind. Okay? Now, Frost being unbelievably precise gives us a clue to just that ambivalence in the way he writes that line, because it's oddly punctuated. Line six. Then took the other, comma, as just as fair. And you think, now that's not quite right. It should say, then took the other, comma, just as fair, if it's an appositional phrase. Or there shouldn't be a comma there, and it should read, then took the other as just as fair. In other words, without a comma, the took goes with the first as and is a verb of appraisal. As this gentleman suggests, there's a mental process going on here. Then took the other as, in other words, then took the other to be just as fair as the first. So if we don't have the comma, we have a warrant for reading it the way you want to read it, right? As a kind of mental state. Alas, we have a comma there, but then we shouldn't have the as. We should have, if took means walk down, then took the other, just as fair and having perhaps better claims. So what Frost has done is to put us squarely in the very conundrum we're now in by the way he enjams that particular line and by the way he punctuates. He wants us to think, I think, is this person youthful, morning consciousness, impetuous, such that he looks, acts, then rethinks? Or is this person autumn-like? He spends most of the first story thinking, weighing things, being pensive, locked in his mind, and expresses his decision, as the gentleman back there thought, with the exclamatory, not, I took this one, but I kept that one. And then, his autumn consciousness further, yet, here's your earlier point, knowing how way leads on to way, I thought I'd never come back. So, what I'm going to now suggest is something hard, but see if you can follow me. You follow me this far. The reason that this is a poem, not a novel, the reason that this is a work of literature is because it's put us as readers in trying to make sense of the poem in the same position that the speaker's in trying to decide what he or she will do. Okay? In other words, we have two paths of interpretation we could take. We could take the took to go with the as, we could take the took to be an action verb going down. We've got evidence on both sides. People over here, or scattered throughout the room, who want to make the decision being made in line six, have about just as good an argument as the people who say the decision's not really made until line 13. So what he's done here in getting us to read the poem this way, by the way it's constructed, is to get our minds caught up in the same kind of mess. How do we read this? How do we interpret these lines? As the speaker's in when he or she decides, what path should I take? This one or that one? And notice, if you say, well, this is something Schwein's making up, notice how clever he's been in suggesting that in the very title of the poem. I often say to my students when I give them a test, okay, the road not taken, which of the two paths does that refer to? Half of them say, well, the road not taken means the road the speaker didn't take. And the other half say, no, the road not taken is the path the speaker did take because relative to the other one, it was not taken. And sure enough, in one narrative, the weight of gravity falls on the road the speaker didn't take, and the other one falls on the road the speaker is sure he didn't take. When he gets much older, he tells with a sigh a narrative, with great confidence, two roads diverge in a wood, and I took. Now we have no doubt what took means, the one less traveled by, in other words, the one I took was relatively not taken, okay, to the other one, and that's made all the difference. Two narratives, two different sets of conclusions, a title that could refer to both, a poem that's constructed in such a way to catch us up into the very conundrums that the speaker's caught up with as he stands. simple, straightforward language, everyday situation, profound comment on how we're disposed to revise, as we get older, our own narratives. As we're caught in middle age, ambivalent, equivocal, thoughtful, going back on ourselves, we're not so sure about much, have lots of doubts. We get older, now the whole fabric and shape of our story takes on a little more clarity, and we tell our grandchildren, boy, when I was younger, I was faced with this fork in the road, and without much doubt, I went down the unpopular one, and that's made all the difference in my life. You see, but that's by virtue of the perspective we sort of have then in part, and it's also by virtue of the need to bring about a certain measure of clarity and wisdom to the shape of our lives then that we just don't have earlier, okay? And all of this is sort of conveyed by the, I think, energies of this poem.
So it's really a process.
Exactly. Very well put. It's really a process. Really a process. Yes?
Is there still a desire for the road not taken, which is after all the title? Isn't there still some sadness about the fact that there is a road not taken and that I can't go all the roads I wish to take?
Excellent. Yes. Isn't there something about the sadness and poignancy of finitude?
Is it then line two? I'm sorry for that. Is he being more than just witty? Sorry, I could not travel both and be one traveler.
I think that's already there. But I think to get to Val's point about a difference in tone, do you catch where the sigh, he tells us he'll be telling it with a sigh, but do you see the sigh in the last sentence? Okay. See where it is?
No.
That's correct. The dash between the two eyes is the sigh. I shall be telling this with a sigh. We're told how we'll be telling it, and then we get to see him tell it that way. I, with a sigh in between, right? And I think Dorte is quite right. We're left with this sense of the old age perspective that this gets to tone, being much more impressed with the sense of finitude, that he can't do all of these things, and furthermore, that the things that we do finally help to shape profoundly who we are and what we become. Choice is existentially formative in determining the kind of beings we have become, a perspective we get clearly from old age that we often lead to a kind of sighing. We sort of have a window, as you pointed out, in the conflict between the morning and the autumn consciousness, but after all, if you read the rest of that first narrative, oh, I kept the first for another day. There's still a sense in which he wants to deny finitude. I mean, yes, I'll do this now, but I can always come back. But then come to think about it, I doubt that I ever will. I mean, you know, there's a resistance to that kind of closure and finitude in the first narrative, which is not there in the second one. Yes, sir.
That line seems to, that seems to be a very youthful line. And then the maturity comes back in the next two lines again. Oh, I'm probably never going to come this way again. And I skipped it. I probably won't be able to come back this way, and I doubt that I ever will anyway. Or I didn't put that word.
No, I think you're being
very youthful when that line 13 and 14 and 15 is much more mature in the process or in the telling.
There's a real irony here in that at the beginning is so strong. He wants to be one traveler. He wants to be unity. And he gets down to the end, he took one road. He only can take one. But yet that made all the difference.
Excellent.
Yes. There's something in that says that what he's doing at the end is a really depressing rationalization of what we do when we grow old, in that we misrepresent what we did when we were young. And that line of saying the sigh means that we have given the short, simple version of what we did when we were young as a way of glossing over all of those complexities, and that that's what we will do to ourselves, is tell these simple stories.
But why not read this as a younger, middle-aged person projecting upon what it's like to be old? And this is what old people are like. They refashion their youth. And how miserable it must be to be old like that, because you're going to invent your history.
And that's still depressing, though, isn't it?
It's depressing about where we are, where we are now.
Yeah.
But the last line there says that has made all the difference. You know, that by itself, it sounds like that's the positive thing. But it really isn't. It doesn't have to be. It's negative. It just goes with the first stanza. That the difference is that I could have gone and done something else. That's the difference.
Well, I think it really does come out to be sort of neutral. You really don't know for sure the meaning of the sigh. You don't know if he's sighing in satisfaction or sighing out of wistfulness, you know, in retrospect.
And of course it's even more complicated, just complex up what he's doing, just projecting that he will be sighing.
Right.
So what do you think this person is projecting that sigh to be? Is it, as these two folks have suggested so well, I think, that the sigh comes, he thinks, as he projects it, in a narrative which is vastly different and self-serving to some degree. And this is really a poignant truth about that the middle-aged person realizes about what it means to get old. Or, as some others have said earlier, is the poem supposed to suggest that by virtue of his sort of middle-aged consciousness taking hold at the end of narrative one, with the second guessing, though, or yet knowing how way me gone to way, I doubt it if I should ever, that word is pretty heavy, ever come back. That leads him to this other reverie, which may suggest that the old person tells a story that has a kind of deeper truth than the middle-aged person can have. So is it a deeper truth or is it a self-deception? I think you two all are suggesting it's a kind of self-deception.
Well, at least though, it's very possible it can be a deeper truth, because it seems to me if at an earlier stage he's longing to be this one traveler that can encompass all of experience and experience a kind of unity, is it possible at the end that he is, with his experience, come to see that now we can really only do that by taking a specific choice-made road, and that makes all the difference. That provides the unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was suggesting that what appears to the middle-aged person as self-deception might, in fact, through the eyes of age, be a deeper truth the middle-aged person doesn't grasp and can't grasp.
The studies of reminiscence therapy for older adults is generally that reminiscence is this time of life when you survey where you have been and somehow it, we need to make it good. You know, this is an important life task to reflect and to create those stories that have sustainability and meaning. And that's an important finishing task. It isn't self-deception at all, it's the creation of meaning and the reflection back on the meaning that we created.
Very nice. So in other words, we're all poets, meaning makers. Mm-hmm. And this poet has managed to write a poem about the work of meaning that we all undergo in making his own meaning, which is this quote, and drawing us into the process of making it by those interpretive quandaries that we found ourselves in the middle of this class kind of caught up into, and catching us up in what you call the process. Well, this has been great. Let's see if I can draw some things together of what Val said, and she is a medical person who's thought and written a lot about end-of-life issues. You could read a book that's written by a social scientist that could tell you a lot, as she just summarized, about reminiscence and about what it means to shape a narrative to bring closure and meaning to your life. you could read the work of a bad poet who would reduce everything, as people have done with this one, to the last three lines, a simple little moral. Or you could be Robert Frost, who is a lyric poet of enormous power, who does something that neither of those two forms can do. By writing this poem, he actually draws us into the very process that he's describing. This poem enacts what it describes. It describes the process in such a way so that by us trying to make sense of it, we're fused with that speaker attempting to make sense of a certain choice in his life. And that's something that only the lyric poet, someone who's a genius like Frost, can do with such simple words and such simple language. I had thought, by the way, and I apologize that we would get to High Little Brook and Spring Pool. This shows you how, I wanted to show you these poems are complex. I think I've shown you these poems are complex. At least I've done that. So those who want to continue, I promise we'll start from scratch together on Spring Pool, High Little Brook, and go on tomorrow afternoon. But thank you all for being such a great class.